Imagine that you are an Israelite. For 400 years, your people have been in Egypt. You were slaves. You were oppressed. You were beaten. You knew hunger and suffering. But then, so your parents taught you, a marvelous thing happened. A wanderer named Moses, one of your people, returned to Egypt with a message from the God your ancestors worshipped once upon a time in a far-off land. Now, with powerful signs, he demonstrated his victory over the gods of Egypt. And with Moses as his prophet, he brought your parents out of slavery into the wilderness. Apparently, there was some great offence when your parents' generation was too frightened to go into the land your God had promised to the people. And for as long as you can remember, you've been living in tents in the desert. It's all that you have ever known. And now, you're camped on the borders of the territory your parents were too timid to take. You know the reports that were made by the spies those 40 years ago. The people there are giants. They have walled cities and trained armies. They have the most advanced military technology of the time. Their gods have established their civilizations for hundreds, in some cases thousands of years. And the God of your ancestors tells you that he will give you this land. All you have to do is obey. Would you? Do you know the promises that have been made? Do you know the God who has made them? Do you trust him to be able to deliver? Into this situation, the voice of Moses speaks. He reads from the words of the scroll he has, with God's help, written. In the beginning, he says. It's one word in Hebrew. He said one word, it's quite a long word. It's two in Greek and three for us. In the beginning. Immediately we're transported back to a time before. Now it's worth noting that in Hebrew the word used for in the beginning refers to a period of time, not just a single moment. I'll say no more about that now, but it'll help you, or those of us who will be here, when we get to verse 2 next time we look at Genesis. This then is a period of time before. Before what? Before everything, in the beginning. Not at the beginning of the year, not at the beginning of the month, not the beginning of the week, nor the beginning of the day, or the beginning of the meeting, but in the beginning. Hebrew is a very economic language. You can say a lot with very little. And this phrase, in the beginning, tells us a lot. For one thing, if we're thinking straight, if we're working things out, we'll realise that for someone to be around in the beginning, that someone would have to be a person unlike anyone else. And that's not hyperbole, that's literally the case. It would have to be a person who predated everything else. It would mean a person who was eternal, who had always been, someone unlike everything else, uncreated. Moses' word, his one Hebrew word, has taken us back to a time which requires a supernatural revelation, an unveiling, in order for us to have any idea of what happened. There was no one there to see what was happening. We're relying completely on what Moses, or God through Moses, is telling us. Now also, if you're still living in the head of an ancient Israelite, as soon as I say, in the beginning, it's going to work like a kind of narrative trigger. It's as if a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away had just come up on the screen. When I say in the beginning, do you, as an ancient Hebrew, start to think of all the creation stories you know of? The stories passed down through the generations, the stories the peoples around you have told you. Moses says, in the beginning, and he draws his listeners into a shared world of symbols and stories. Things that they were all familiar with. It brings it all to mind. That is deliberate. We'll see that as we work through this chapter. He wants you to bring along your preconceptions, all your biases, all your prejudices, all the things you think you know. They will help him as he tells this better story, even when it's just to shoot holes in what you believe. Now, additionally, there's something very important to note about this word. There are other ways in Hebrew of saying at the start. There are other ways this book, there are other ways the Bible could have opened. We call that a countertext, a way it could have been said, but isn't. Instead of all the other ways of saying in the beginning, Moses chooses a word which automatically brings to mind the idea of the end. Very often in Hebrew, the words will be linked together in a phrase, the beginning and end. You'd say the beginning and end of the year. The beginning and end of the reign of King so-and-so. This isn't like a stopwatch. You've got to stop thinking like a Westerner if you want to understand the Bible. It is hard to do. You need to step out of the box that you live in and try and see the Bible the way the people to whom it was originally written would have understood it. It's not like a stopwatch. That's not what's happening in Genesis, starting and just ticking on ad infinitum. This isn't evidence for a God who would set creation going and just leave it to spin. That's called the God of deism. Sort of God sets everything going and then steps back and just leaves it. This is more like a countdown starting. This is the beginning of a plan. We might think we talk about Genesis as a book of beginnings, but this book is all about the future. In the beginning, the eternal, uncreated God had a plan. Well, that's one word. There's only another 32,000 to go. Moses' first word got your attention. You've looked up from what you were doing now. In the beginning, he said, and the camp was immediately silent. His next two words land like a bombshell. God created. Now in Hebrew, it's actually the other way round. Created God. You can imagine him leaving a dramatic pause between the words. In the beginning, created God. Now he uses the word, as any of you who've studied this in detail will know, Elohim here for God. Now we already know, and if you're a Hebrew hearing this for the first time, you already know that God's particular covenant name is Yahweh. And that's the name Moses will happily use in just a few pages' time. But here he is very careful to use Elohim. There's probably a reason for that, or several reasons. And it ties into something I've said just before. Now remember how that phrase, in the beginning, immediately gets ancient Israelites thinking back to all the other creation stories that they're familiar with. The Israelites were a people descended from Abraham, who came out of Mesopotamia, sort of in the east, Iraq area it is now. And they've just spent 400 years in Egypt. Both the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians, along with every other people group in the ancient Near East, have stories explaining how the world was created. If you learn nothing else from reading Israel's history, you'll realise that at every stage, they had too much of everyone else mixed in with them. You try living in one culture for 400 years and not pick up some of their habits, some of their beliefs, some of their ways of being. And the Israelites were always slipping back into non-Israelite ways of seeing the world. Non-Israelite explanations for the why things were the way they are. Now some of you, I don't know, might be shocked. Some of you might already know, but there is significant overlap between many pagan creation myths and the Genesis account. Many of the details are the same or similar. Now, some people will argue, and they do, that this just goes to show that you can't trust the Bible. You know, the Israelites were just another ancient people, and this happens to have been the one that sort of caught up with modern culture. But I can't stress strongly enough how foolish an idea that is. There are similarities, because those similarities are deliberate. Moses knew what he was doing. In his word, God tends to speak in ways, using terms and symbols, that people will actually understand. The Bible was written to be read and comprehended. And so Moses is perfectly within his rights to borrow whatever terminology he wants from pagan religion, from religions that the Israelites will understand, in order to describe the truth of creation to the Israelites. The similarities are sometimes striking with other creation accounts, but they're not nearly half as astonishing as the points of difference. People who try and draw the comparisons often leave out the differences. And they say, oh, well, you know, this is different here, but why don't we focus on this point of similarity? They're completely missing the point. In everyone else's creation account, creation is a team effort. You know, some proto-chthonic god or gods creates the physical world. And then another god comes along and creates the stars and planets. And the stars and planets are themselves gods. And then there's probably some kind of conflict with where the greatest of the gods, I think it's Marduk in the Babylonian, and there's others in similar accounts. He has a big fight with a chaos dragon or a serpent. And that, either deliberately or semi-accidentally, creates the sky and the sea. He rips the dragon in half, and that bit ends up sort of sticking to the roof and becomes the sky, and that bit sticks to the floor and becomes the sea. And then another god comes along and creates the humans, and so on. There was never the idea in any other ancient religion that a single god would have the interest, let alone the ability, to create everything. And yet Moses just said, you just heard him say, in the beginning, God created. Now here he doesn't say Yahweh, because he doesn't want the Israelites to think he's talking about their God as if he were just a particular tribal God. You know, like the Canaanites worship Baal, the Egyptians worship Ra, and, you know, we worship Yahweh. He wants them to know that the God they deal with, the God it is their privilege to worship, the God who's made such great promises to them, is the God. He alone is God. He's the only one deserving of the title. The only creator. The only one on whom creation relies for its continued existence. The only one who has ownership rights over all that he's made. But perhaps you think I'm overplaying my hand, narratively speaking. After all, Moses hasn't said what God created yet. As you stand there with all your Israelite neighbours just coming out of their tents to hear what Moses has to say, you're waiting with bated breath to hear what he has to say next. Maybe you think he's going to explain how the Hebrews are sort of created especially by the God that they worship. So they aren't even the same species as the people around them. That's why they're so special. And maybe he's going to say how in the beginning God created the mountains of Canaan. So it's his particular land to share with the Israelites, if he's so minded. It's like, it's my land, I'm the boss, I can decide who can move in. Now perhaps with your half-pagan brain, you're wondering about what particular piece of creation it is that your God has a particular interest and oversight of. Is he the God of harvests? You'll always be able to rely on him and sacrifice to him if you want to get a good crop of barley. Is he a fertility God if you want to have children and fill the land? Is he the God of the sea? Which would be not a bad God to have if you're bordering the Mediterranean. You could, you know, have reliable shipping and trading and plant colonies around the Med. In the beginning, says Moses, God created, he goes on, the heavens and the earth. You could hear a pin drop. Did he really just say that? Now don't misunderstand this. Moses isn't saying that God is responsible for the heavens and the earth and nothing else. This is a turn of phrase called merism, or hendiadys. I don't know if I've pronounced that right. It might be hendiadys or hendiadys. If I say to you, anyone is welcome, young and old, you know that I mean everyone is welcome, not just only old people or only young people. It means all, from old to young. So when Moses says the heavens and the earth, he's not limiting God's creation. He's saying, in the beginning, God created everything. The heavens and the earth and everything in between. The spiritual world and the physical. There is nothing left out. Everything comes under those words. In the beginning, God created. Now, this might seem simple to us, but to put it mildly, the Hebrews would struggle with the idea that one God could be responsible for the creation of everything that is. Just think about it. If you look at a well-constructed chair, say a wooden chair, these plastic ones are a bit not a good example. It would be reasonable, say, look at this chair, to assume that one person, a skilled carpenter, an upholsterer, could have made that chair. That's not unreasonable. One person. If you look at a house, you would assume that a team of builders were involved, although it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility that one hard-working grafter could have done it all, given enough time. Now, some of us have had the pleasure to go on open days to BAE or even work there and see these enormous nuclear submarines, giant things. There is no doubt in your mind but that it takes the thousands of people who work at the shipyard to build such a massive and complicated thing. What about the whole of creation? The heavens and the earth. That's way more complicated than a chair. It's bigger than a house. It's more complex than a nuclear submarine. How could even hundreds of people be responsible for all of creation? Every other ancient people imagined the gods to just be extrapolated, superhuman versions of the people they were. Their gods were small. They were born. They could reproduce. They could die. Even though they were still much higher than mankind, they needed to be placated in order to lead a quiet and happy life. In the first seven words of the Bible, it's seven in Hebrew, God wants his people to know that he's not merely a powerful person. You can't understand him if you start with human traits and just extend them heavenwards. He can only ever begin to be understood by stopping up your mouth and listening to what he has to say. Whatever you think you know about God, you need to forget it if it doesn't fit with what God has told us about himself. In the beginning, God, and only God, created the heavens and the earth. we're going to see as we work through this chapter, Genesis is intensely monotheistic. There is only one God, and it wants you to know that. It corrects the pagan polytheism, the worship of many gods, that the Israelites had absorbed from the cultures around them, that they'd swallowed hook, line and sinker in their 4 centuries in Egypt. But before I conclude, I just want to make a single aside. I've been trying to help you to appreciate these words by getting you to step into the shoes of an ancient Israelite. But we can't. We just can't ignore the New Testament when we read it. We've got a whole Bible. We need to use the new to interpret the old. And this verse is full of Christ. I say that confidently because we read in Colossians 1:16 regarding the Son, for in Him, in the Son, all things were created. All things, everything, heavens and earth. Things in heaven and on earth, because Paul doesn't want you to misunderstand what he means, so he goes on to expand it. Things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through Him and for Him. Therefore, if God takes such pains to point out in Genesis 1:1 that He alone, on His own, without any help from any other sub-gods, He created everything that was created, so that no other created thing will steal worship which is rightly owed to Him. To read those words from Colossians about the Son, Jesus Christ, we have to realise that He must be fully God, the same God, God in three persons, blessed Trinity. Or the Bible is a lie and we are all idolaters, worshipping some created thing rather than the God of the Bible. This book, given to God's people at a time when they were in desperate need of it, was given to establish that God has a plan. It was given to establish who He is and how His creation is to relate to Him. It shows us the folly and the worthlessness of giving our praise to anything else. It shows us the folly of relying on any other rock for our salvation, and the absolute stability of the rock on which we stand if we lean on the One who has always been and who had the power to create everything. You stand now on the verge of Jordan, ready to enter the promised land. What giants do you fear? What skills do you lack? What weaknesses overcome you? What unconverted family members do you pray for? What kids do you have that you worry about raising properly in this messed up world? What problem is there in your life where you are wondering, does God have the power to deal with it? Does God have the power to save me? Can I rely on this God? In the beginning, this God created the heavens and the earth. Hear the word of the Creator God. Know that He has a plan for His people, and He most certainly has the power to fulfill every promise that He has made.